Welcome to the Real Estate Mastermind Live, your go-to podcast and radio show for real estate investors seeking insights from industry leaders. Join hosts Seti Gershberg and Jay Tenenbaum, founders of Scottsdale Mortgage Investments, along with Edward Brown, head of investor relations for Pacific Private Money, as they dive into strategies for raising capital, closing lucrative deals, and scaling your portfolio. Tune in every week at 6 a.m. on Saturdays on KSFO or on your favorite podcast platform. Get ready to elevate your real estate game with the Real Estate Mastermind Live.
Welcome to Real Estate Mastermind Live radio show. I'm your host, Edward Brown, along with my co-host, Jay Tenenbaum and Seti Gershberg of Scottsdale Mortgage Investments. Jay is off today. Real Estate Mastermind Live is a radio show for real estate investors who want to learn from industry experts. We'll show you how to raise more capital, close bigger deals, scale your own portfolio, and more. We're also having a trivia question this week, so make sure to listen in. You'll want to participate in the prize we're giving away. Our phone number is 888-912-1190 to answer the trivia question or ask us a question. Special contest today is to win the Pro Note Calculator that that Scottsdale Mortgage put together. It's kind of a cool spreadsheet that goes over real estate. It's worth $179. The first caller with the correct answer is going to win that Pro Note Calculator. So, first of all, Seti, let's first go into what is happening at Scottsdale with your trade desk and kind of explain what that is to the audience.
Sure. So we have an active trade desk where people can buy notes. We have a very unique platform in that we provide some education on a monthly basis for people so that they understand various exit strategies on actual notes. So they're live. It's not an academic exercise. It's an actual live exercise. So we'll take several assets that we own and talk through what we would do in terms of evaluating and analyzing the note and provide several different exit strategies on those notes. And this is done in a Zoom platform. We usually have 30 to 50 people come on, typically individual retail investors who are looking to get in the space because they are interested in finding out how to create income from non-performing loans or profit from non-performing loans, because you can do both. And when you get on the trade desk, you do have to sign an NDA, and that lets you into our kind of exclusive VIP club, so to speak. We have, I think, somewhere around 450 individuals who participate in this. And then every month we send you what's called a tape. Tape is nothing more than a spreadsheet that lists a series of non-performing loans that we're offering for sale. We teach you how to bid on these loans. We teach you how to analyze the loans. We teach you how to exit from the loans.
Well, and let me ask you a quick question. How much competition is there from if you have 450 people registered, but let's say only 40 or 50 show up at a time, how many people are competing for a specific note? You know, because you don't want to.
Sure. It is a competitive marketplace, no doubt, like anything else. I mean, if you go to the auction, if you're, let's say, a fix and flipper and you're looking to purchase a home to flip, when you go to that auction, there's a lot of people there, and you have to bid. So this is a very similar type of platform. You get a little bit more time. I actually think it's a little bit easier to bid with us. And let me give you an example. So from last month, and Tyler, you correct me if I'm wrong in terms of the numbers of bidding parties, but I think there were about 8 or 9 different bidding parties. One bid on, probably about 12 loans. And then we had someone bid on 3 or 4, and we had a bunch that bid on 1, and we're looking for the highest buyer. And what you really need to do is, if you understand the exit strategies and figure out a way to profit from the loan that someone else hasn't done, that's really the art that helps you make money in this business. And you may be looking at something that someone else doesn't look at. So for example, one person might want to modify this loan and collect an income stream. And perhaps his income requirements are lower than a person who wants to acquire the property so they can fix it up and flip it, because they're looking for a higher cash out. So depending on how you bid.
The thing I like about this business is the fact that, and the way you're doing it, is you don't have to have millions of dollars. I mean, some of these loans you guys have shown, that could be as little as $20,000. And so someone can actually, either potentially own the real estate or at least get involved in real estate for not a huge amount of money.
Yeah, well, that's true. And you know what's interesting? My first transaction in the note space was in 2018. I purchased a portfolio of 21 assets, and you got to sit down for this one, for $85,000. So this was like the tail end of the worst properties or assets. We call them assets because they're loans. That were available from a hedge fund who had acquired these after the Resolution Trust,
Oh, yeah.
financial crisis situation. And they were just sitting on them and it was their tail and they wanted to get rid of them. So we bought them for about 11 cents on the dollar. But I have to say, these were terrible properties. Some of them were really unlivable. And we did wind up turning that $85,000 portfolio into a $60,000 a year income stream for several years
Wow.
and wound up selling most of those properties. Probably collected somewhere near about $60,000 to $70,000 on selling them. And then we still get $1,800 a month on it. So, that was a massive win.
Yeah.
And that opened my eyes to this. So you imagine if you take 85,000 divided by 21, you're buying these properties pretty cheap. Nothing's out there like that now.
No.
But like Edward said, yeah, 20,000 you can. I know we had one for 36,000 on this tape. 36 to 100,000, there's certainly opportunity out there.
And what kind of rate of return generally are people looking for when they're bidding on these? Or what can they expect? Because I know it's going to be whether they modify it's going to be one price, whether it's going to be to acquire the property and turn it over. Do you guys have any kind of metrics on that?
Well, everybody has their own investment target. So that really affects the amount that you're going to bid. The lower the return that you expect, the more you can pay. So you might outbid someone. So someone who has a, 10% income stream expectation is certainly going to do better than the person who, wants to make a 45% return on a flip, right?
Sure.
That's the type of situation that you're in. But someone's going to have to want to buy the home too. Like, for example, if you have a rural property, you're probably not going to find someone who's going to want to flip that because it's going to be hard to do.
Gotcha.
But that one might be better for an income stream.
And for the audience who's listening in, if they wanted to get involved with this, how would they get in touch with you?
Well, you go to our website, which is mortgageinvesting.com, and you click on the trade desk tab. You fill out the form, we send you an NDA, you sign it, you send it back, and then you'll be on our mailing list and receive our newsletter, invitations to our monthly note symposium where the education takes place. And by the way, we're probably going to start offering some more serious education. It's sort of in the works at this point, where we will have, full training with workbooks over a period of time. And that'll really hone your skills on learning how to be a note
That
trader.
could be a good income stream for you guys if you got 450 people who are interested, and some probably are not as sophisticated as others. They'd probably be willing to pay to go to your class, so to speak, or to get your information.
Well, there's definitely going to be a price point, but what we're wanting to do is offer it, lower than some other places out there. The reason is that we have a portfolio of loans and we'd like the individuals who we train to be able to buy on our trade desk. So if they're built-in customers, we don't have to charge as much as other companies that are just doing education and then they don't support you after that by providing loans.
All right, well, if you don't mind, let's go ahead and move on to our guest. Why don't you introduce Wolf?
All right. Well, Wolf Trigo is an accomplished financial strategist. He's a licensed agent and he operates across many states and offers a diverse range of financial services. He has a meticulous, personalized approach. He places great importance on delivering exceptional results that are tailored to each individual client's unique needs. From in excuse me, from in I don't know why you can't say it. From infinite banking to private equity and commercial real estate, all the way to monetizing commodities, he has found a way to provide solutions for almost anybody. Welcome to the show, Wolf.
Thank you so much. Appreciate the introduction, Seti.
So, there's one thing in there that I didn't see, and I know you're really into motivation and things like that, and I think we'll be talking about that a little bit later. But before we get into that, why don't you give us a little bit of your background, where you're from, how you got into this space, what you've been doing?
Absolutely. Absolutely, man. So I was born and raised in Barcelona, Spain. And, when I watched my dad build a logistics business from the ground up. And when I say logistics, I mean more on the export and import of goods. He had a lot of clients in the Middle East and Eastern Europe. So I basically grew up watching, business, an individual person working on very large transactions and large clienteles. And to be honest, like, my dad was my hero and I just wanted to be somewhat like him. I wanted to do big business, but I don't know if you guys know much about the economy in Spain, but it is probably not the most favorable place to actually start a business. So I'm extremely grateful for my mom that basically applied for my green card and just immigration visa when I was like six. And when I turned 16, I ended up having the opportunity to move to the United States. And I only chuckled because at the time I didn't want to go because I had all my friends and I was like a rebel kid and just I was a mess, so I didn't want to leave Spain. And when I got to the United States, I was like, okay, I'm so happy I did this. I'm glad I listened to my mom. And after that, I finished high school like very reluctantly. I'm not the smartest tool in the shed, but I knew I had a knack for business, so I just wanted to make sure that I pursued that path. And what better place to do it than the United States?
Let me ask you a question. First of all, I've been to Barcelona a few times. Like, we've done cruises and stuff. I love Barcelona. It's absolutely
Nice.
beautiful. You said it's not the easiest place in Spain, but
Correct.
explain why. Is it the regulations that they put on?
Yes. So I was very young when I left, so I wouldn't be able to tell you very specifically why it is not the best place. But what I do know is from a lot of people that are still living there, the tax situation is absolutely abhorrent. Meaning you can, I mean you can, but like if you make more than 60,000 euros a year, you're getting taxed upwards of 40% plus. So just imagine, even if you want to be a very successful business owner, there's a lot of corruption in Spain, including in the politician level, but which I'm assuming it's in every country. But in Spain, it's very like it's very forefront. Like, they just don't care. It's like, yes, I'm corrupt, so
Well,
what?
it's interesting. When we were there last, there was big protests going on with, is it Catalonia?
Yeah, Catalonia. Yeah, that's where Barcelona's from. Yeah.
And the way it was explained to me, and again, I don't know how true it is, but it's like, well, why do they want to like separate out? And apparently, it was like there was so much business in Catalonia, and they were feeding the rest of Spain, and they were going,
Yes.
we want to do this. Let's, we want to break away, be our own people. And I don't know how much of
So,
that.
to tell you the truth, that's a great assessment. So, I mean, obviously, maybe there's a little bit of ego in there, right? Because to say that one state or like one little, I don't even know if the word is state, but like one region is supporting the entire country, I think it's a little far-fetched to say, right? Like, most people
Sure.
know Spain for Barcelona and Madrid. So I think that Barcelona is huge and Catalonia is huge for the tourism, right? But there's other states like La Rioja, which is really good for wine. There's a lot of places like, for example, Madrid is very huge for their tourism as well too. We have Extremadura and Galicia for like cheese and other different type of agriculture. And it's just, I think every part of Spain brings a lot to the table, but certainly Barcelona is huge for the tourism. So that's why they wanted to break off, is because they just wanted to be their own, which I understand. If you were to look back hundreds of years ago on the history of what Catalonia is and what the Catalan people are, you would kind of sympathize with them, and I have to say, I used to sympathize with them a lot too. Now, not to say that my views have shifted. Now I have a little bit more of a balanced look and outlook on, why things are the way that they are and why they shouldn't really change.
Interesting. Okay.
But again, we can talk about that for literally hours.
I just I just thought I'd throw that in there. So
No, appreciate the ask.
share more about your approach to infinite banking and how it differs from traditional methods.
Yeah, man. So when I got started in the industry, it was almost a decade ago. It was back in 2016 when I first got licensed. And I never really heard about infinite banking until a few years after that, around 2018 or so, when I had a client of mine that said, it's like, hey, I want you to read this book. What would the Rockefellers do? I want to figure out how to be able to lend myself money out of my cash value and still capture the interest of the policy. And at first, I told him, I was like, hey, there's no way that that's possible. That sounds like a scam. I was that negative Nancy. And my client told me, he's like, hey, look, I'm not your client for you to tell me what we can't do. Go figure out how we can do it. And he hung up. So at the time, I became extremely obsessed. And I started to realize that a lot of people really don't know how to structure these policies. Because to be fair with you, the way that I use infinite banking today is using Indexed Universal Life. And the reason why I believe that's superior than whole life is because regulation has changed a lot, to the point that if you even look at the charts of the guaranteed rates of dividends and whole life, it's reduced quite substantially since the 80s. So back in the 80s, you could get 12 to 14% dividends, and now they're barely at 4%. So the trend shows a downward spiral. So that's why infinite banking using IUL makes a lot better sense, because you have a lot better capability to make arbitrage on your money. But on top of that too, the way that we structure the policy is, like, I became obsessed over the past 6 years. I became obsessed on how to really truly structure it to the best benefit of the client, while at the same time including the trust setup, the complex trust setups, to completely bulletproof them and privatize them, to the point that they can have the similar method as the Rockefellers call it, the waterfall method. So all in all, the reason why we're so different than 99% of other agents and other people that say that they can do infinite banking is not only just on the structure of the policy itself, but it's because we also add the trust component on it, complementary. So the client doesn't have to pay extra to get the trust set up.
So I know. I mean, I still actually have an active life insurance license since 1984.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So believe it or not, I'm still getting paid on disability policies I sold back then. In fact, my
I
clients are
love
ready to
that.
retire now, so it's kind of interesting. I mean, it's like
I
pennies.
love
It's not a lot of money.
it.
And so, if I understand it correctly, the you don't get a tax deduction for the money going in, but you get it growing tax. Free, and then you can take it out tax free by borrowing against the policy. Is that basically how it works?
So that's yeah. So it's pretty much accurate. Now here's a caveat to that. In most cases, life insurance premiums are not deductible.
Correct.
Now here's the caveat to that. There is a way you can structure a corporation that can own one of these policies. It's called a COLI, a corporate-owned life insurance policy, that if it pays the executive an executive bonus plan and the beneficiary of that policy is not the corporation, any premiums going in are tax write-offs. So now the company got a tax write-off for any money going in, and now the client or the insured, the executive, got a tax-free benefit that's going to grow tax-free. Now he's going to be subject to income tax at that point, because obviously,
Oops.
like the tax went, the tax liability went from the business to the
To him.
individual.
Yeah, so
Now, what
the
I like to
individual is
say,
going to still pay tax. The corporation gets the deduction for the premium, but the policyholder, the executive, pays taxes on what that premium write-off
correct,
theoretically would be. So again,
correct.
it's
So the
still.
example I like to give people is, like, in my opinion, I think that's better than just paying. For example, if you owe the IRS $100,000 as a business, it's
Yeah.
better to pay yourself an executive bonus plan of, for example, $100,000. So now instead of paying the IRS $100,000, you have to pay only like what, $20,000, $30,000, as an individual. I think, in my opinion, I think that's a lot better than having to pay $100,000.
So you're saying that the individual tax rate is lower than the corporate tax rate?
Well,
Not
I wouldn't
necessarily.
know specifically that, but my point is, if the business makes $1 million that year as a corporation, and let's just say after all write-offs and everything, he still owes the IRS 100,000, and then they funnel that 100,000 through an executive bonus plan to the individual, to the executive of the company. In my opinion, it's better than the corporation gets a $100,000 write-off, and then the individual pay the taxes on the 100K that they got, as opposed to having the company pay the full 100,000.
Yeah, it's an interesting way of looking at it. I see what you're talking about. Very interesting because in theory, somebody's still getting a tax deduction and someone's still getting a taxable event.
Correct, correct. It's just you're mitigating the taxes at that point.
You have to process that. You know,
Yeah,
we're on the app.
it's
I
one of those
don't
things
find it
that,
all the time, but it's
yeah,
interesting.
it's one of those things that you have to have a good accountant or a good tax attorney that understands how these plans work. And by the way, none of the stuff that I'm saying is stuff that I just put out of my hat. I have gone through some resources and people that have experience in the field, like tax attorneys and accountants, enrolled agents, or people that know the tax code better than I do. And they do confirm this, you know. So again, it has to be a very specific type of structure to be able to get that write-off. Otherwise, like you said, it's like the premiums going in are not write-offs.
Yeah, because you gotta make sure that the corporation, what they own the policy, right?
Yes.
And so that's
And the
how
caveat to that is that the corporation cannot be the beneficiary.
beneficiary. Yeah, so they get to control the policy, but the
Correct.
beneficiary is still going to be, let's say, the wife of the executive.
Yes, exactly.
Interesting.
Exactly.
Yeah, very,
Exactly.
very, very. And then now when it comes time to building up the value, who gets to access that? The owner?
So the owner of the policy and the insured as well too.
Oh, either one can access.
Yeah, and technically speaking, it's all based on whatever agreement they have in place. So, for example, there are certain policies that the company maintains full ownership until the client is vested. So, for example, we use executive bonus plans to be able to help businesses entice loyalty, right? Or reduce employer attrition. So, for example, if you have a trucking company that has a bunch of different, truckers and, whatever, for whatever reason, they want to make sure that those people stay in that company. The corporation can set up one of those executive bonus plans on those key employees that, for example, has like a 10-year vesting period, meaning that they cannot access that money. They can't touch that money until they've been there for 10 years. So that sometimes people can look at it as like a private pension plan or
Yeah.
some sort of of benefit like that.
And can a single person incorporate and do it that way?
Yes.
Okay, because they don't
Yeah.
have to worry about all the employees. They're the only employee.
Exactly. Well, to give you the truth, like to tell you the truth, that's how I did it myself last year. So
You're
that's how I set it up
nice
myself.
and young, so the premium's a lot lower than someone my age.
Yeah, well, the cost would be a lot lower, correct? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
Yes.
I know generally the idea is that, to try to make sure it's not a mech. And in
Yeah.
fact, they didn't even have that when I first started doing insurance. They didn't have the modified endowment contract, and they eventually,
Right.
what happened was people were taking advantage of poor. They'd have a, let's say, a $100,000 policy, and they were trying to put in 60,000 a year in premiums because they don't want to pay
Yeah.
too much for the insurance side of it. And the
Exactly.
IRS finally said, "Wait a minute, this is too
Yeah,
good
and that's
to be
when they
true."
rolled out with the TEFRA, DEFRA, and
Yeah,
TAMRA.
exactly. Yeah, very interesting.
Absolutely. So
Okay,
tell us a
so
little bit about for people who are listening that don't know what universal life is, and you said IUL. So yeah.
give an explanation of what that is and how it works and how that's different from a whole life and term policy.
Absolutely. So, well, the biggest difference is like there's two different types of policies of life insurance policies. There's the term life, which just like it sounds, it's for a specific period of time. So what I like to say is like imagine like you're renting your life insurance. I mean, sure, it's great because it's cheap, but at the end of the day, you might want to be able to own it because otherwise you're gonna die. So if you're just getting a life insurance policy, it might be a good idea to just own what you have so that way you don't have to worry about it, final expenses later. So that's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is going to be the permanent life insurance. And within that, there's basically two sides. There's a whole life and then there's the IUL. The whole life is great for people that are just wanting to get a specific final expense product that they don't really care much about the premiums going in. They just want to be able to get something cheap that's permanent, for the rest of their life. Now, for people that are using whole life for infinite banking, I used to hate whole life all the time. But throughout the years, I started to realize that, whole life is not really a horrible product. It's more of a it has its place in the marketplace. And the way that I look at it's a great substitution for a high yield savings account, for example. So anybody that just wants a conservative rate of return, that just wants to accumulate it, that they really don't care that much about the leverage factor on it, whole life is a great tool as well too. And even for the people that want to leverage the cash value in the whole life policy, it works kind of like a low interest loan. Because at that point, even if, let's just say your policy is performing at 4 to 6%, which is the conservative rates that whole life agents are saying, and your loan is costing you 5%, at the worst case, you're paying 1% on the loan, and the best case, you're still making 1% arbitrage on it. So the pros on whole life is that the cost will never go up. Now, the downside to that is because the insurance company won't be able to raise the cost later on, or the cost is basically fixed, the initial cost of the policy is quite substantially higher than a traditionally, or like that a properly structured IUL policy would be. So what an IUL would be is an index universal life, which the way that I like to say it is that it grabs the best of both worlds. And both worlds meaning the variable market, which would be the stock market and different indexes, as well as the safety of the life insurance. And what I like to say is like, it's like the much better optimized version of the hybridized child of whole life and you know stock market accounts. So for me, IUL is probably one of the best vehicles out there because you can get a lot better performance and a lot cheaper cost in the beginning. So throughout the years, later on, you can essentially outpace the cost by a lot.
All right, guys, we're going to cut to our commercial break here. Here's our trivia question. And as a reminder, Wolf, if you know the answer, don't say anything yet. The question has to do with the NBA, since we're going to be getting into basketball playoffs here pretty soon. Which player has played the longest in the NBA? Now, I think he's since retired, but who's basically played how many seasons? What's the most amount of seasons? You know, who's played the most? You know what I mean? You know, Will Chamberlain, let's say, played 10 years. You know, some other guy may have played 15 years. Well, that's more, right? So basically, which player has played the longest in the NBA? All right? Okay. Call 888-912-1190. First caller with the correct answer is going to win that special Pro Note calculator worth $179. Stay with us. You are listening to Real Estate Mastermind Live radio show. Don't touch that dial. We're going to be right back.
We all know in this current real estate market, great deals are hard to find. We have a solution for you. Sign up for Scottsdale Mortgage Investments' exclusive trade desk by visiting mortgageinvesting.com and get exclusive off-market real estate deals delivered to your inbox every month. Scottsdale Mortgage Investments' trade desk delivers unique opportunities in off-market mortgage notes, including performing loans, non-performing loans, and REOs. Visit mortgageinvesting.com to sign up today. That's mortgageinvesting.com.
Welcome back to Real Estate Mastermind Live radio show. I'm Edward Brown, your host, along with Seti Gershberg. Jay Tannenbaum is off today. Our trivia question, which player has played the longest in the NBA? Anyone?
Well, I'm not a huge sports nerd or anything like that. And to be fair with you, I haven't watched that much the NBA, but the only name that came to mind was Michael Jordan.
No, actually, it was Vince Carter.
I got it.
I got it.
Vince Carter.
That is correct. What do you
guess? How I knew?
You Googled it.
Artificial intelligence. Perplexity.
Oh, is that right?
2 seconds.
No, I say I call it SETI intelligence.
Yeah, search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Yeah. The funny thing about that is, like, you tell me where is the terrestrial intelligence?
Good point.
I think we should be searching for that.
Yes, it went away with the eclipse. Seti, you want to reintroduce our guest?
Sure. We've got Wolf Trigo on, who is a specialist in infinite banking. Yes, I said
right.
It right that time.
And yes,
he was just talking about the differences between term whole life and indexed universal life. So let's take that one step further. You said that these policies are really great to build cash and borrow against them and then have a death benefit that you can use. You said there is a way to do it where it's tax deductible. And then you said that there's some type of trust that could be married to that. What is the advantage of the trust, the name of it, and how does that help?
Yeah, so the way that the trust works, and so I have to give props to Ed because obviously he's been licensed for quite some time, so he does know a lot about them. But basically, the idea behind it is that you want to make sure that the policy is a not MEC policy, a non-modified endowment contract. Now, here's the thing. You can actually take it a step further to that with people that don't mind making it a MEC policy. And the reason why you would want to make it a MEC policy is only if you wanted to put, for example, like a single premium. Because there's investors out there that I have that say, look, Wolf, I just don't want to put money every single year into it. Well, I don't want to put money every month to it, you know, because my cash flow varies all the time. What if I just put $1 million once and that's that? Usually on a traditional structure, if you put $1 million once, it would basically MEC the policy. So how to be able to structure it correctly to the point that the person doesn't have to worry about the taxes that much is that you have to have the policy be owned by the trust. Because at that point, when the trust gets the 1099 form from the insurance company as a MEC policy, the trust can defer those taxes until the end of the trust lifetime. So by that time, again, you have one executive trustee, and then you have the successor trustee, and so on and so forth. So there's ways that like you can essentially extend the trust in perpetuity as long as it's done correctly. So that's one of the ways that we can add that. The other side too on the trust is that leveraging life insurance inside of a trust structure, number one, gives you a lot better protection. And what I like to say is it's bulletproofing your entire financial situation. So a lot of the times it is probably better to, on paper as a person, not own anything, but be able to control most of it. That's why the Rockefeller waterfall method is so important, because now at that point, the trust opens a policy on one of the Rockefeller heirs and makes the trust a beneficiary. So whenever the policy owner or policy insured dies, the death benefit waterfalls back into the trust. And at that point is pretty much protected and has different guidelines that makes the whole situation bulletproof. So the type of trust that we like to use, they're very proprietary to our firm. And I say our firm as if it's mine, but we're partnered up with Wealth USA, and the way that they do it is proprietary. They've been doing it for over 60 years. And it is basically a multi-layered private express trust structure. It's a lot more complicated than that. And like I said, those secrets are usually kept for clients.
Okay, well, that's good. So we have talked to people about infinite banking in the past. And one of the things that other guests have said, and I have a feeling you're going to have a different response, so that's why I'm asking it.
Sure.
What they do is they offer the lowest death benefit possible to
yep.
save on insurance costs.
Yep.
Is that an approach that you take as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the thing is most people that write IUL, they start with the most people that know how to write IUL for infinite banking purposes, they will set it up as a low death benefit. Now, here's the thing. You can still set up a policy with a low death benefit and still mess it up completely. Because again, there's more than just setting up the lowest cost of insurance, because it also determines on if it is a guideline premium test or a cash value accumulation test. It also matters if you're doing an increasing or level death benefit, if you're doing an optimal switch. There's so many different configurations that IUL has in order to be able to be structured correctly. But yes, the structure behind IUL or infinite banking, whether it's whole life or IUL, it is to have the smaller death benefit. The reason why is because death benefit drives cost, cost drives target premium drives commission.
Okay, so let's turn this toward real estate a little bit. You have this universal life policy. You've funded it and you've been paying your premiums, and now you have a nice cash balance in there, and mm-hmm. you decide that you want to buy a mortgage note on Scottsdale Mortgage Investments trade desk. So
Absolutely.
You have this life insurance policy in this trust, and you borrow some money out and you go ahead and you purchase this note. You work the note out in a couple years. It's taken to foreclosure. And your legal balance on that note, you know, let's say is $100,000, and you paid $75,000 for the note, and the house sells at auction for $150,000. So your full loan gets paid off, and you've made $25,000. So can you
Actually, you
put
made more. You bought it for 75, you sold it for 100, 150.
right, but the legal balance was 100. So
Oh,
your legal balance on the
gotcha.
loan gets paid off, and we can't collect anything above that
Gotcha.
because that's what's owed to us. So the 100,000, now I have $100,000. I started with 75. Can I dump that $100,000 into this policy?
So yes and no, meaning yes, as in a way that you can obviously pay back your original loan of 75,000. And then also meaning that the remaining 25,000, you can add new premium to it. So here's the misconception that a lot of people make when they say become your own banker and pay yourself back the interest and all stuff. You can't put more money than the annual premium guideline is. Like if you've set out your policy to only be able to put $50,000 a year into the policy, you can put 60,000 or 45,000, like depending on that limit, right? So the only way that you would be able to put more money in there would be, again, if you paid back your loan and then you put it towards new premium for the following year. And sometimes if that anniversary date hasn't come up, what you can do is you can set it up on a premium deposit account by the insurance company that right now some carriers will offer 2% guaranteed or 3% or 5%, whatever the case. But basically it's kind of like a holding account or holding tank where now the insurance company, when the anniversary date comes, they'll pull your money out of that and then credit it towards the premium. So, and the only reason why you can't do that is because then you would be violating MAC guidelines, and there's, like I said, it becomes a whole mess, unless the
You're
policy's
saying we
been.
can do MEC in a trust because we can defer the taxes forever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That was my next one, right? Unless it's structured specifically to become a MAC under a trust, then yes, at that point, then yeah, there's no
You'd want
problem.
to structure it to be a MEC under the
It all depends. It depends because again, if you're putting a single premium and you don't want to put more money into it after the second year, right? And you don't really care about whatever tax citations and all that kind of stuff, then yes, you want to set it up as a MEC policy inside of this private express trust because now the trust is just going to defer the taxes in perpetuity. Otherwise, and again, that structure is not fit for everybody. That structure is usually fit for people that have a taxable bill of 50,000 or more a year. So until they get into that point that they have to pay that much in taxes, it's just not going to make sense. It's going to be better used as an individual policy, traditionally structured policy, without having to worry about trust and MECs and all that kind of stuff. Just because otherwise, it's just going to be the maintenance to be able to keep those kind of trusts is just. It might just not be worth it if you're only putting like 10,000, 50,000, or whatever.
Okay, cool. That's really good stuff. So, I'm going to ask you, what is the Circle Syndicate and what's its significance?
Yeah, so the Circle Syndicate is basically a mastermind group where basically what the purpose of that group is to be able to connect other like-minded entrepreneurs that are essentially in the same wavelength, whether it's like in the US or Dubai or Bali or Europe, whatever the case may be. And they just want to be able to find a meeting spot where people essentially are getting together and doing deals on whatever scale, whether it's crypto, whether it's real estate, whether it's commodities and such. And I do have to make a distinction. Ever since actually you and I met, I stepped down as a CFO just for different reasons. I am still part of the group and I still respect those guys that have started it a lot. And like I said, I'm still affiliated in different areas with it. But what I would say is that the biggest finality in it is if there's people that want to be able to find people in the world that's not just limited to the United States, the Circle Syndicate is a good starting point just because there's a lot of different connections to be made across the seas that are in that group.
How do you meet?
So you have to become a member, and I believe that there are certain memberships that the owners Kane and Ali have set in place. They have an Instagram presence too, and you do have to go through a vetting process to be accepted to be a member. And then they have quarterly meetups that are going to be worldwide. I believe the one in May is happening in Bali. The last one was in Miami. And there's another one planned in Dubai for the third quarter. And then as far as the communication goes, everything is happening through, I believe they have a either Telegram or WhatsApp chat where people usually meet there and they follow basically the guidelines of communication.
All right, very cool. So we talked a little bit before about an interest of yours in motivation and mental health, specifically men's mental health. How do you think that
Yes.
intersects with the financial industry, and what steps can individuals take to prioritize their mental well-being?
Yeah, so I don't know how much how candid can I be on this show? I just want to be respectful.
We do have FCC regulations, so you can't swear.
Okay, as far as like swearing, I'm not going to be swearing, but as far as like being candid, like is it okay to get heavy or?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. So the only reason why I say that is because, you know, in the financial industry, mental health happens to be one of the pretty much like the number one reason why a lot of people you know they just commit suicide. And I would be lying if I said I didn't toy with the idea myself. I have struggled with that for a long time, not because I wanted to quit or because I just didn't like my life anymore. It's more because of the insane amount of pressure that you have on you and because of how stressful this industry is. And a lot of the times, it is almost like a Red Sea where all you go, like anywhere you go, the people that you meet usually are not only just in competition, but they're trying to take you down just because they feel like some sort of authority position that they want to make sure that they stay there. And I have encountered a lot of situations where I have looked for guidance for people that had a lot more tenure with me. And I've been, you know, sidelined. I've been circumvented. I've been torn down in many different ways. And, you know, as an immigrant and the son of a single mom, the pressure is insane to be able to make sure that, you know, my family's taken care of. Because I took the risk in 2019 to go full time. And it's something that I wasn't really ready for. And at the time when I passed my license in 2016, I told my mom that she never would have to worry about money ever again. And obviously, as we all know here, when it comes to entrepreneurship, it's never as easy as that, right? So it took me a long time to be able to be in a position where I am today, where I am in a much better place mentally, where I am able to provide for my family. But for the past 9 years, man, it was very rough. I felt like I was inadequate. Even though I'm young, I felt like I needed to be much more ahead. And a lot of the times people in my industry and my people that are my age, they overlook the fact that a lot of the people that are very successful, they're not in their 20s. Usually, the people on Instagram that are flashing the money and all that stuff that are my age usually made their money through crypto or, you know, whatever, Amazon and all that kind of stuff. But to really be able to make a sustainable business in the finance world without scamming, without taking money from people, without lying, and doing it the right way, it takes a career. It takes a long time. And it's one of those things that I've always had my battles with. It's like, yes, I love this industry, but at the same time, I also hate it because it's robbed me from spending time with my family because I can't afford to take one day off, you know, because I have to go out there and make it happen because I don't have a salary. I don't have a boss. I don't have anybody signing my checks. I don't clock in. You know, it's like whatever my value is what the market decides, is what my clients decide that it is. You know what I mean? So for me, men specifically, it is one of those things that it's that silent killer. You know, suicide is a silent killer, and a lot of men don't really talk about it. And I wanted to be able to bridge that gap from the finance side to the blue collar as well, too, because the blue collar men, they also feel like they can't talk about it, right? Because they've been taught to be bootstrapped in. You know, it's like, hey, you're just the man. You know, you can't, you know, complain about anything. You at the end of the day, no matter how depressed you are, you still got to bring the bread at home. You know, you can't really talk about it to your wife. You can't talk about it to your children because they can't see you crumble. You know, so that for me, aside from all the infinite banking and investing and all that kind of stuff that I'm very passionate about, my biggest passion is how do we bridge the gap? How do we help other men to understand that, hey, like you don't have to talk to your wife about it or your kids about this kind of stuff, but you can find some other men that are also going through this. You know, like just because someone is more successful, just because someone lives in a higher rise or whatever the case may be, or they're traveling, it doesn't mean that they don't deal with their own issues. You know, they don't deal with mental health issues. You know, on Instagram, I'm always super happy, right? But people don't really know what really goes through my head. You know, the images that I see for the past 10 years where I was inadequate, where I try to commit suicide 2 times. You know, people don't really see that. You know, and I think it is important for other men, for other outstanding men like you guys too, to be able to showcase to other men that, hey, look, it's okay. You know, there is no need to be able to put this facade. Like we're okay.
You know, it's interesting. I was just talking to a couple of guys from church, and we were talking about basically the same sort of thing. And it's just good for guys to get together and talk. You know, not
yes.
Sometimes, you know, we go through a book, and other times we just relax, be guys, you know, to help each other. You know, it's yes. It's therapeutic.
You know, yeah, it doesn't need to be business, right? Like, I'm sure you guys are always working. I understand that. I'm always working as well, too. But sometimes, isn't it refreshing to be able to get together with a friend where you know he's not going to be your client and he's not going to try to sell you on anything? You're just literally your friend that you can just enjoy a meal with, or a cigar or a drink or a workout, a movie, you know, that.
Yeah, so I belong to a men's group, and I think it's great. We get together every Thursday and have dinner, and then we do meetups and have, you know, discussion sessions every Sunday. And a part of that is all about, you know, building the masculine energy, which actually helps you in your relationships with women. You know, a lot of times guys will get in relationships with women, and they've been hanging out with all their guy friends forever. And then they just disappear, right? It's a voluntary thing. It's not that the woman asked them to do it. It's that the guy does it on his own and then stops hanging out with his guy friends. And then if you don't build that masculine energy in, sometimes there's, women don't get that kind of sense from you. Yeah. And, you know, it makes things stale sometimes. So hanging out with guy friends, discussing things like what you're discussing, and other issues, relationship issues, you know, just makes us better people and better in relationships in general and better with our significant others. So I think
it's because, sorry to interrupt you, but I think it's because a lot of men, they've been taught the wrong idea of what masculinity looks like. That's why a lot of the times there's so much ego involved with some men. You know, that when you're with guys, you always have to be the better guy. There's always have to be some sort of one up in each other, right? And that's when the term of toxic masculinity came about, which is, I have a friend that he said that the real masculinity is not toxic. The toxic masculinity comes from insecure men that are tapping into their feminine side and masking it as masculinity.
Perfect. That's a great way of saying it, because you're 100% right.
You know what I'm saying?
Women want real men, and that not
yes.
not that toxic men. You know, got to be a brute
yes.
all the time. I mean, you got it's okay to. They want to see vulnerability because it shows transparency. But they also want and you want this for yourself. You want the strength. You know, again, it's not it's not a toxic, it's not a one up, one down type of thing. It's just, you know, men and women are different. You know, their DNA is just different. Forget all this woke stuff and, you know, men becoming women becoming, and there's no difference between them. No, there are differences. Not
there
that
are huge
better,
differences.
But it's like, you know, my arm can't do what my leg can do. It's not that one is better than the other. They're just different and they have different roles. So
they have different purposes. That's right.
Different purposes, exactly. So,
Wolf, did you do anything specifically to kind of get you out of, let's say, the funk and where you were at? Like, did you read books? Did you get a personal coach? Did you get advice from anybody? Like, how did you get from your very low point to where you are now?
So I have a couple of ideas that really, really help me. And I only call them ideas because it's what worked for me. It might not work for everybody, but the number one thing I had to do was for me, the number one thing that worked for me was having a really strong relationship with Christ.
Sure.
I'm very, very grateful to say that I got baptized this weekend, which was an amazing step into my journey with Christ. But I got super close to him over the past few weeks, and
Oh,
I can't express how happy I am and how not happy. I think happy is not the right word. How at peace
joyful,
I am,
joyful. It's peaceful
joyful.
and joyful. Yeah.
Yeah, peaceful and joyful, right? Because in the Bible, Christ never talks about happiness. He always
No,
talks about peace.
joy. I came to give you joy and joy abundantly. I'm a what they call a messianic Jew. So
Yeah, okay.
I've been Jewish all my life. In fact, I actually consider myself more Jewish now than I was before. You
Oh,
know,
nice.
Jesus was a Jew, right? It's just the
Yeah.
unfortunate thing is that and growing up being Jewish, we never, you know, there was always something about Jesus that and unfortunately Christians gave Jesus a bad name. You know,
Yeah.
and so you have to really get to know who Jesus really is. And then, you know, it's
Yeah.
funny, it first hit me on a logical level and then a spiritual level. And we can go
Yeah.
into that at another time, but
No, absolutely. Yeah, we can later talk about that for a long time. So yeah, so
yeah.
for me, with my relationship with Christ, it changed my life completely. But then other than on the outside too, I got into jujitsu, man. And it's interesting because I think a lot of people compare jujitsu with being an entrepreneur. You know, when you start, you have no idea what you're doing. You're gonna get choked out. You're gonna get submitted. You're going to get gassed out. Like literally, you have no idea. And as you continue to go, as you continue to fail, as you continue to really understand how every move and positioning matters, that's when you start to really getting some wins. And you're never gonna be undefeated. There's always gonna be someone who's going to outmaneuver you, who's gonna outclass you, right? But that's the beauty of jujitsu and the beauty of business, right? Like, you guys are all successful entrepreneurs, but I'm sure you guys can probably remember the last loss that you guys had probably a couple months ago. But it doesn't mean that you guys are bad business owners.
Well, you
It just
look
means
at Abraham Lincoln. He failed what? How many times in not only business but politics?
lots.
Yeah, before he
Quite a
became
few. And
president.
Sam Walton also, he went through six bankruptcies before Walmart took off.
Oh, Walmart?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. It doesn't mean that like a bankruptcy or a failed business, loss of a client, it doesn't mean that you're just bad at business. It just means you won once, and this loss that you took is because you needed to learn something from it. That's it. That's why jujitsu was so big for me. And besides, too, aside from just learning how to position myself in life too, when you're getting choked out, when you're in a very bad position that you need to get out of, I promise you, dude, you are not thinking about what someone said, the client that you lost, or any other mental issues you're having.
Tap out,
You're thinking either I have to figure out a way to not tap, and if I do tap, I have to tap before I pass out. You know what
yeah.
I
Yeah,
mean?
hopefully you can tap before you pass out.
Yeah, exactly. So that to me, jujitsu saved my life too because it gave me purpose other than business. You know, because I was that workaholic that I was literally like from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. in the office,
Yeah.
and I would get home and then I would sleep, I would eat, I would probably say, a couple words to my mom or whatever the case, and then that's it. And then I moved out. I was alone. I had nobody else to hang out with. And a lot of men, they go through this cycle too, that what do? They become womanizers, because they miss the affection of another human being. And that was my situation too. And I had to completely change who I was.
Wow. This is a good way to end the show. We have to get to our boy Wolf. That was really very good though. You know, you kind of talked about a lot of things, not just business,
Yes.
which I really appreciate.
I
So
appreciate you
if
guys.
people are interested in getting hold of you though, how do they do that?
Yeah, so they can find me on Instagram. I think Instagram is probably the best way to understand what I do and how I help people. It's Wolf Trigo. It's WULFTRIGO. Or if they want to reach out to me directly, should I give my cell phone?
No, just that'd be a good way to do it. All right,
Okay.
here we go. Here's our thoughts for the day. So one time I dreamt I was Ebenezer Scrooge
And after I was in the dark, after not paying my utility bill, I was visited by the ghost of Christmas past due. Give a man a gun and he will rob a bank. Give a man a bank and he will rob everyone. Tune in next week to Real Estate Mastermind Live. We're going to be discussing various aspects of real estate and asking another trivia question. Thanks for listening. On behalf of our team, I'm your host, Edward Brown. We'll see you next week.